This is Booked. I'm Tim Shank, your host, and I'm here with Meg Jacobs today. Very happy to say that. Meg is a historian at Princeton and a leading member of a cohort of American historians who are rewriting the way we think about the political history of the United States in the 20th century. And we're here today to talk about her latest work, Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s, just out with Helen Wang. And if we have time later, reflect on her work more generally. But let's start with Panic at the Pump. And let's start at the beginning of it, which at least the proper narrative starts with George H.W. Bush, a young man setting out to Texas in the aftermath of World War II. Why begin there with this character?
That's a good question, and thanks for chatting with me about the book. I start with George H.W. Bush. He heads out, as you say, in search of oil to West Texas after graduating from Yale, and he decides he doesn't want to follow in his father's footsteps and go into the whole investment banker world. Instead, he wants to make it on his own, albeit with some family help. And he has this idea that the sort of new booming field is going to be oil. And he's a useful place to start because it captures this sense that Americans had throughout much of the 20th century, really until the Arab embargo in 1973, that we were invincible, that we could live this lifestyle of abundance predicated on cheap and plentiful fuel, and that could go on forever. So he, in his own quest, in his own search for oil, embodies that whole sort of mid-century perspective. And then he's useful as a bookend because we'll come back to him later where the book ends in the Gulf War. Yeah.
George H.W. Bush isn't often thought of as a very ideological figure, but you argue that at least with regard to oil, he had sort of a distinct position that fit very nicely within this emerging conservative movement.
You know, what's really sort of interesting in telling the story of American history and American politics through oil is you get a sort of different landscape of conservatism. Mm-hmm. You can appreciate some things that we've known. So, for example, the centrality, of course, of the Cold War, but a new take on it, that is to sort of put resource issues, particularly oil in the Middle East, sort of front and center, even earlier than we might think in the 1970s, to sort of be aware of a different kind of geopolitics, one that sort of moves beyond Europe or Southeast Asia and sort of focuses our attention. And with that perspective in mind, people like George H.W. Bush early on are very worried about American invincibility. What starts to happen after about two decades of Bush being quite successful in the oil business is we start to reach our peak of domestic production. And so Bush is very well positioned to know the threat that this might pose to American interests and the sort of vulnerability that might result. So you have him articulating early on the need to roll back regulations. For example, all the new environmental regulations, because this will pose a threat to our standing in the world. And it's from that perspective, this sort of deep commitment to deregulation, that I think is front and center for conservatives like George H.W. Bush, animated with a foreign policy dimension, but very much committed to sort of undoing the sort of regulatory world that the country has lived in since the New Deal and beyond.
But as you explore in the book, that commitment to deregulation wasn't so much in evidence in Richard Nixon's initial response to the crisis. So why that very different approach?
Yeah, so Nixon, you know, who we think of very much as a sort of conservative ideologue, gets elected first in 1946 on a sort of anti-communist ticket. And yet Nixon is incredibly pliable, is politically opportunistic. And of course, he grows up in the New Deal world. And he understands when Americans are feeling some kind of pocketbook distress, that it's government's responsibility to do something about it. So two examples of how Nixon sort of defies our characterization of conservative and liberal is, one, he embraces the environmental movement, and two, which was even more popular among American voters, he puts into place across-the-board wage and price controls, which you would not think a Republican would do. And he was sort of flexible in a way that people like George H.W. Bush and soon after him, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, and of course, people like Milton Friedman thought would surely be the end of American industry and American power.
So what happened when the price controls were put in place? Did they work?
Well, you know, George Shultz, I think it was him who famously explained, you know, this will be like Vietnam, you know, easy to march in, impossible. And this is exactly what happened. So Nixon puts in price controls in the summer of 1971. He's thinking about the reelection, and he feels that if he puts in price controls, he'll tamp down inflation, and then he can stimulate and juice up the economy right before his reelection. But the problem is he can't get rid of these price controls. And so he's sort of saddled with them. By 1973, when the oil crisis begins, the only controls that are still in place are still those on the energy industry.
So let's talk a little bit about the oil crisis specifically, and I guess the energy crisis that's a part of more generally. I think that most people, when you hear it, some people will have specific memories of it. A lot of us will just have sort of vague images of long gas lines. What exactly was the energy crisis?
Well, the energy crisis, as Americans understood at the time, which is very different than our understanding today, which is sort of more concerned with climate change. The energy crisis at the time was a supply crisis. That is that the abundance that George Bush discovered out in West Texas was disappearing. Americans were becoming more dependent on imports, and this was driving up inflation and also making the United States vulnerable on the world stage. And so the energy crisis, as Americans experienced it, was a shortage of this precious commodity, one that was vital to every aspect of American life, from fueling your cars to heating your homes to powering industry.
Who did Americans blame for this at the time?
Well, that's a really good question. What most Americans did not know is that we actually imported any oil at all, because that was a relatively recent phenomenon. So as I mentioned before, we were reaching our peak of production. Nixon saw this. He's very worried about this. So Nixon, through his executive power, makes a decision to repeal a ban on imports and to let imports into the country. So between 1970 and 1973, the number of imports doubles, and we are importing about a third of our oil needs. Americans don't know any of this. So who do they blame? They blame Richard Nixon. They blame Washington politicians for not providing better protection. And the number one villain in their mind are the big oil companies, known simply as Big Oil. So the idea is that these all-powerful oil companies, precisely because they hate all of these regulations, the environmental regulations, the price controls, are imposing an artificial shortage, that they've withdrawn oil from market to try to force Congress to repeal and get rid of all of these measures. The idea is that all these oil tankers are waiting offshore, and as soon as prices rise, they'll come ashore and gas will return. So Big Oil is to blame. And you have everyone going after Big Oil, from Ralph Nader and the sort of emergent consumer movement to liberal Democrats. And politicians in turn get blamed for not coming down harder on Big Oil, for not extracting more oil out of them. Scoop Jackson, who's a Democrat from the state of Washington, who has political ambitions himself, realizes that he can make political hay over this shortage that ensues as a result of the Arab embargo by calling all of the leading big executives of Big Oil to Washington, and they line up at the very same table of the Watergate hearings, and he leads what he calls a cheat probe and accuses them of charging obscene profits. And this is sort of the popular mentality at the time.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about Jackson? He's one of the most fascinating characters in a book that's filled with them. Because at least for me, like, I've come across Scoop Jackson in the past, mostly as just sort of this predecessor to the neoconservatives. People always talk about his foreign policy, but the domestic record and sort of the very liberal aspects of his Cold War liberalism aren't often as in evidence.
Yeah, he's really interesting. So he sort of typifies the endurance of a New Deal liberalism, right? So he has this idea that you can use price controls, even rationing if necessary, that the solution to a shortage is some type of Manhattan Project or big TVA project, that these are problems that government should solve. And he's not alone in this. So you have we often sort of think of the 70s as the rise of conservatism. That's the way the decade is usually framed, the sort of incipient grassroots sort of that will culminate with the election of Reagan in 1980. But in fact, these New Deal liberals are still very strong and powerful. And he's at the center, along with people like Ted Kennedy and Tip O'Neill, which is why you have price controls in the first place, right? Because Nixon's facing a Democratic Congress. They pass this measure sort of cynically, not thinking he'll ever
Yeah, the measure like allowing, giving him the power to enact price controls,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then he sort of outflanks them. So, you know, it's this really interesting period with these New Deal liberals on the one hand, concentrated, you know, in sort of the Northeast, Midwest, and then you have people like Scoop Jackson too, against these sort of emerging conservatives inside Washington, many of whom are in the Nixon administration, people like George H.W. Bush, who see what they fear most about the energy crisis is the expansion of government that will happen as a result of it, and they can't withstand the tide.
One of the things I love most about the book is the way you follow how the energy crisis ramifies. So it's never just like put off in its own little silo. You see it overlapping with civil rights. You see it with the Vietnam War. You also see it with Watergate, which pretty soon enough will have Nixon out of the White House and lead poor Gerry Ford to take over.
Right.
So what happens to him when all of a sudden he's charged with managing American energy policy?
Yeah, he's really interesting. Probably one of the least studied presidents, but I think he's really quite interesting. And
consequential, too.
And really consequential and more ideological than we think of, sort of more ideologically pure, in the sense that he's been fighting from the inside for a long time. You know, he's been a very powerful Republican in Congress. That's why he's tapped to step in as the vice president, because the idea is it'll be a quick confirmation. But he's used to sort of fighting from within and articulating the minority position. And when he comes into office, he really tries to be sort of a conservative on many issues, aside from appointing Nelson Rockefeller, which was sort of, you know, a sop to sort of the moderate. If you look at his policy, including on energy, he really is trying to push hard for a market agenda. So, for example, 74-75 is a recession. He doesn't really want to budge on this. He does not want to do any kind of stimulus. He believes first and foremost that the problem is inflation. He believes that the biggest thing that's driving inflation is energy. His solution is to actually get rid of controls, because that will stimulate the market. It's kind of a classic Milton Friedman argument, who was sort of writing this week in, week out in his Newsweek columns, that you'll stimulate the market and it will start to produce again. And this is how you will turn a shortage into a glut.
Yeah. Another point that you're very astute on, and it's just something that I feel like people have acknowledged, but you do a lot of effective work with, is pointing out how for an administration that it's only around for a short time, has a massive sort of institutional legacy and just the bodies, number of people who are there who end up making their way through Republican ranks later, is a huge sort of like institutional legacy from Cheney to Rumsfeld, just as sort of the most obvious examples. How does this group that's only around for such a short time, why do they have such a long-lasting impact on policy down the road within D.C.?
Well, I think it also really is formative to their understanding of what they want to do and how Washington
Yeah, you
works.
Say that the energy crisis was for this like rising generation of conservative activists what the Great Depression was for New Deal liberals in the 1930s.
Yeah, right. And so the same way that sort of Keynesian economics animated them, the sort of Friedmanite, you know, free market kind of ideology, you know, motivated them too. And again, you know, the idea that this that the solution to this crisis was more regulation was abhorrent to them. And so, you know, back to Nixon for a second, but continuing on into the Ford administration, a really key guy in all of this is William Simon, mm-hmm. who's a really interesting figure, right? So this conservative ideologue who has this background as on Wall Street, here we are, and he comes to Washington as an assistant secretary of the Treasury, and then Nixon appoints him as the first energy czar. So it's this really odd thing that this guy who's sort of steadfast against government intervention in the economy has to make decisions like, should the Daytona 500 go on as planned, or should it be the 450? You know, these sort of heavy-handed decisions and involvement. And so he, for example, who then will become Treasury Secretary under Ford, knows better than anyone the sort of danger that the energy crisis poses for their sort of deregulatory agenda. And intimately tied to is their sort of world view. You have people you identify as neoconservative. You have people like Irving Kristol, for example, deathly frightened that if we continue to be dependent on the Middle East, that we will weaken our position in the world, and that soon enough our allies will abandon us. So Dick Cheney, for example, during the 73-74 embargo was the ambassador to NATO, and he saw, for example, the way that some of our European allies were willing to sort of make bilateral deals to protect their access to oil. We think about the oil crisis as just a crisis for the U.S. The embargo targeted the U.S. because of its support of Israel, but what policymakers, especially in the Ford administration, were very worried about were our European and Japanese allies, who were much more dependent on Middle East oil for us. And they saw this as a sort of crucial arena for the Cold War.
And actually, this flow between domestic and international policy, and also the weird endurance of certain institutional figures, brings to mind another important character and another really fascinating one in the book, James Schlesinger, who is introduced as Secretary of Defense under Richard Nixon, and then pops up as the first Secretary of Energy under Jimmy Carter. Who was he, and how does he make that transition?
Yeah, so he's fascinating, and he's a sort of interesting study along with Kissinger in a certain way. They have much of the same pedigree.
Quite literally, right?
Yeah, so Harvard, you know, they do all of their training at Harvard, but Schlesinger, unlike Kissinger, is an economist, and he thinks in terms of resources and access to resources. And so during the Arab embargo, he was quite frustrated because there was no possibility. He's Secretary of Defense, and the military options are just off the table. And, you know, true, there's no dropping of bombs or use of conventional weapons, but this is a blockade targeted at the United States that some saw as a sort of energy Pearl Harbor. And there is Schlesinger sort of incredibly frustrated that there can be sort of no show of force because of the war weariness over Vietnam. And so with that off the table, he continues to sort of try and figure out how can we achieve or reestablish American independence. You know, Nixon, when he sort of announces his first response to the embargo, declares Project Independence, which by framing it that way sort of suggests the problem, right, that we are now dependent. And everything in our energy policy is going to be aimed towards making us self-sufficient. So this is sort of an early version of drill, baby, drill, so that we can be sort of less dependent on insecure sources. So it's interesting. Carter taps him to become the first energy secretary, and it's through Scoop Jackson, who recommends that Schlesinger sort of get this job. There was no way Carter didn't feel that he could tap him for a more traditional defense position, but to the extent that Carter sort of bought into this fear and this concern about energy security, it made sense to sort of put Schlesinger in that role. And so here again, you have one of these guys, he's a Republican, who's in charge of overseeing all, you know, this new department with tens of thousands employees on its first day, because you gather up all of the sort of people working on energy scattered throughout the government. And here he is, not unlike William Simon, saying the very problem is that we're too involved in our domestic market. And he actually anticipates in 1979, when there's instability in Iran, you know, there's going to be a shortage, and we're going to get blamed. So I know you're a Democrat, and I know you have people like Tip O'Neill and Ted Kennedy breathing down your neck to sort of protect the pocketbooks of your Democratic constituents, but you should rip off the Band-Aid, get rid of controls right now, because otherwise there's going to be a shortage and we're going to get blamed. And that is exactly what happens in the summer of 79.
So how does Schlesinger then fit in with the Carter approach to energy more broadly? He's like one element, but there's obviously sort of a much larger apparatus at work here.
Well, Carter is really sort of, they are pretty simpatico, you know, to the extent that Carter is this transitional figure. As you know, he's not a traditional, you know, New Deal Democrat. He's much more market oriented.
Is there sort of like a technocratic mentality that's bringing them together?
Yeah, and sort of, you know, he's the small business peanut farmer.
Like the engineer, right, who just wants to, like, solve the problem.
Right, and he believes that, you know, and so, and that's kind of what we think of him for, along with the sort of Baptist preacher sort of, we need to use less kind of thing. And Schlesinger was not averse to any of that. I mean, what they shared was this idea that we actually need to get rid of controls. the Republicans wanted to get rid of controls to stimulate production. Carter wanted to get rid of controls to stimulate conservation. So, you know, this is sort of a precursor to the debates over supply side and how you sort of remedy the economy. But the end goal would be the same, that you would have increasing energy prices. The Democrats found this to be abhorrent, or at least the Northeastern liberal Democrats found it to be abhorrent.
Yeah, it's an attack both on the poor and on some of their voters, right? If you're concentrated in the Northeast, like if you're Teddy Kennedy, this is a double hitter.
Right, exactly. And so what's interesting about Carter is the way in which somebody like Schlesinger really sort of embodies his beliefs about what has to happen. And so we remember Carter, we remember the cardigan sweater, we remember the melee speech where, you know, the message is the same as in the cardigan sweater speech, which happens a week into his office, which is, you Americans, you indulge too much, you need to cut back. That is the solution to our energy crisis, use less. Not a very popular message. Carter is caught because there's sort of three different constituents in the Democratic Party, and he needs to speak to all of them, but is sympathetic really to only two of these constituents. So one constituent is the South and Southwest, where all of the energy producers actually are. They're not in the Republican Party yet. They're still in the Democratic Party. And they, like the Republicans we've discussed already, are certain that the problem is too much government interference. And so they put a huge amount of pressure on Carter to, and in fact, he had promised them, you know, in his sweep through Texas and Oklahoma, you know, I will remove controls. He tried to sort of have it both ways. And they're quite committed to their point of view. And the sectional sort of strife over energy is really interesting. The way, unlike the 1930s, where economic problems kind of could unite the South and the...
A national depression.
Energy splits the Democratic Party. So you have bumper stickers, drive 75 and freeze them alive, you know, in Louisiana, Texas, and Oklahoma. The idea, you know, is we got a lot of energy here. We won't share it with you unless you sort of let us sell it for whatever price we want to sell it for. That's one constituency. Another constituency are all the environmentalists. And you're right, Carter is this sort of technocratic figure. He's the guy who installs solar panels on the roof of the White House. He makes a promise to the environmentalists that by the year 2000, we'll get 20% of our energy from the wind and the sun.
You do see that sort of New Deal spirit there. It's right, the solar energy will be our Manhattan Project, the big government program we can all get behind.
Yeah, except for that's not the bet that Carter ends up making. The bet that he ends up making is something that nobody's ever heard of. If everyone remembers the gas lines, no one remembers the United States Synthetic Fuels Corporation, which was Carter's sort of big play. It was and infuriated the environmentalists because this was a coal-based kind of thing where you make coal into other kinds of energy. And this goes back to Carter's sort of foreign policy perspective, which is feeling very insecure being dependent on the Middle East. So, you know, stumps for this and gives speeches, you know, across the country, particularly in coal regions, you know, the United States is the Saudi Arabia of coal and therefore we'll be okay. And amazingly, he gets this massive bill through Congress. Everyone's kind of holds their nose and votes for it. No one's really particularly excited for it. And it's sort of the wrong bet. And it doesn't really achieve anything for him politically. And then there are the Northeastern liberals who are just sort of furious at Carter for not doing more to sort of relieve the economic distress that's caused by the energy crisis.
So do you think Carter was doomed to fail? Like, is this a failure of just politics? Is it policy? Like, what went wrong here?
It's easy to sort of vilify him. It's easy to look, well, you know, academics and journalists are kind of split on the melee speech because lots of people love to champion the message, you know, of sort of we need to cut back. But in reality, it wasn't a message that Americans were very receptive to at the time. And so in that sense, you know, you could sort of see him as doomed to fail. Because there was no big, as James Schlesinger says, you know, the basic constituency for conservation, you know, is the future. And no one, you know, no politician wants to sort of stake their fortune on that. Mm-hmm. And so that was really hard. Plus the sort of sectional tensions within the party were really hard for Carter to overcome.
So this book is, and I see it as very much of a piece with your first book, which is called Pocketbook Politics, Economic Citizenship in 20th Century America, and focused like chiefly on sort of New Deal era United States. And one through line I see running between them, we've talked a lot about sort of Washington politics in the book so far, because you spent a lot of time there. It's very astute analysis. But in both of these books, you're concerned with that. But you also make a lot of efforts to link up what's going on in D.C. with what's going on the ground outside of Washington.
Yeah.
So let's start with Panic at the Pump and work our way backwards then. In a way, it seems like the story here is not of the federal government forging sort of this dynamic and successful relationship with people outside Washington, which is, in your account, very much a story of the New Deal, but rather the federal government alienating Americans at every step along the way. Can you talk about how that played out in
this period? Sure. You know, that's an argument that I see is really at the core of the book. So, you know, if Watergate and Vietnam taught Americans that they could not trust their political leaders, and the energy crisis taught them that Washington didn't work. And so what I set out to do when I was writing this book, I wanted to sort of see the story of how Americans become disattached from government, that sort of unraveling, which you call alienation. I wanted to sort of see if I could really investigate that coming undone of what the New Deal and World War II had built up. And so for that, I look to the grassroots and the gas lines and the intense sort of anger that builds up. So that sort of reaches a climax when you have Levittown, Pennsylvania, which is sort of, you know, these Levittown suburbs are sort of the iconic symbol of post-war prosperity and peace and harmony. Levittown, Pennsylvania goes up in a gas riot in the summer of 1979. Where you have these truckers blockading the intersections where all the gas stations are, and then local citizens coming and joining in, lighting two cars on fire and chanting, more gas, more gas. And it's this moment of alienation, as you say, and really sort of disentangling the faith that citizens had in government to fix their problems. So Carter, Kiss My Gas becomes a popular bumper sticker.
Yeah, the violence of some of these protests is a really striking element in the book. Like,
yeah.
Just like how invested people were just emotionally. They felt like they're, in some cases, you know, you dwell a lot on truckers, right? Their livelihoods are at stake in this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the reason that I settled on Panic at the Pump, besides the fact that it alliterates, is because it's that panic mentality. And when you have a panic, right, which is a phrase that the press uses all the time in this period, when you have a panic, you have to really think why is there sort of a crazy mentality. You know, part of what drove the gas lines was not this shortage. The shortage was never very acute. So, and there are debates, economists love to debate what was the actual number, but, you know, 5%, you know, 10%. I mean, not enough to really sort of re-alter America. But that didn't matter. The perception was that this was the end of American life as citizens had known it. And the reason that they go rushing to the gasoline stations to top off, as it were, is because they have this fear that no one's going to sort of help them. No one will handle the crisis in any kind of orderly way. And so you have this irrational, almost consumer behavior where drivers are driving around with a month's supply of gasoline in their tanks rather than keeping it in the ground, thereby exacerbating the shortage. You know, you have people lining up to the point where they run out of fuel on the gas lines. You have fist fights. You even have some murders. And it is this sort of panic mentality that I think comes in the wake of a sort of vacuum of leadership.
Another key through line running between these books is the question of inflation, which you argue is sort of this like crucible for mid-20th century liberalism. It's this constant threat. It's always threatening to break apart the coalition, even in the sort of the golden age of like Truman through Kennedy.
Yeah.
And then the 70s is when it really comes like to the crisis point. So why is like the liberal coalition in particular so vulnerable to this threat of inflation?
Yeah, so the short, glib answer, right, is that Democrats do depression better than they do inflation because they have more tools at their disposal. So they can sort of stimulate the economy to trigger, you know, they can prime the pr- prime the pump, as it were, and they can do this through developmental projects like TVA, they can do this through Works Progress Administration, they can do this through Public Works. You can sort of
they can just cut
this.
Taxes, they can do monetary policy, traditional Keynesian remedies.
Inflation is harder to sort of control through these kinds of tools because there's nothing really to give out. There's only stuff to take away. And so
growth is when liberalism is working and inflation is when it's coming apart.
Yeah, and inflation sort of triggers, and we see this in the energy crisis, which I think is really a tangible way for Americans to fight about and debate the larger problem of inflation in the 1970s. We see the sort of effort to blame different constituents for who's causing the energy, the inflation, and you could see this with the energy crisis too, in ways that trigger debates on things that seemingly have nothing to do with inflation. So, for example, in the 73-74 shortage, this big emergency energy legislation gets pushed through. It's what sets up allocations and price controls and all these amendments, which are really sort of fascinating, which are about who should have less so that I can have more. So, for example, and this was popular, an amendment to ban busing on the idea that, if we're really facing a shortage, a scarcity, then how could we possibly indulge in this social policy? So shouldn't we get rid of busing, which is kind of this very convoluted connection, but made sense as Americans were dealing with these difficult to solve economic problems.
And I think about this too, just thinking about potential like figures who are like linkages between the first book and this one. One of them might be like another Texas politician with close ties to the oil industry, namely LBJ, mm-hmm. sort of like rises to power like from Texas. And he's one of the people who connects the Democratic national establishment with oil money in this mm-hmm. like very explicit way. And he seems to be sort of like anti-union on the ground, but like a very, at least early on in his career, but a sort of public works new dealer and can be like a protege of FDR's in that sense. So I guess maybe this is going back to the why Carter failed question.
Yeah.
It's like so much of, you know, pocketbook politics, it's about organizations like the Office of Price Administration during World War II, which these are the groups that like help set that New Deal mentality and convince Americans that price controls actually can work. Why does this program, which seems you have so many instances of it being so successful in the sort of the zenith of American liberalism, why does it collapse so spectacularly in the 1970s?
Yeah, again, I think, you know, it's just the nature of the economic problems are mm-hmm. difficult. So, for example, Carter shares with William Simon the belief that inflation actually is a bigger problem than depression. Right. So, but none of the Democrats believe this, and you can only sort of and Carter is the one who actually appoints Volcker. Right. And so
he'll be chair of the Fed and start a recession as a consequence.
Right.
Of his
and so that's
inflation.
How you actually deal with inflation. You trigger a recession. But that's not in a policy that's going to be acceptable for a Democratic president to fully sell to a Democratic Congress. So the short answer is that the problems are, the nature of the problems sort of divided rather than united.
So from this perspective, was Ronald Reagan smart or was he just lucky?
Like on all fronts. he was also dogmatic. And so the very first thing that he does, irrespective of what the consequences were going to be, the very first thing he does through executive action when he becomes president is he abolishes all of the price controls on energy. That's the first thing that he does. And I think there one reporter quips, you know, dogma is his best friend. And it's sort of the symbolic act, that he's finally, you know, that the nightmare of the 70s is over and he's pardoned the oil companies and all this. But he then gets lucky because what happens is the oil markets start to shift. So he comes in at the peak of oil prices. And then because oil prices were so high, they trigger additional, they do two things. They trigger the discovery of additional supply in places like the North Sea, and also they trigger private industry, in part also through some of the public policies that Carter puts into place to be more energy efficient. So you're starting to use less, and so what had been a shortage turns into a glut, and you have the collapse of energy prices, which Carter then can sort of trumpet, Reagan then can trumpet as this big success for him. And he fully embraces this sort of mentality of filler up and more is better. And when he runs in 1980, he can use the energy crisis as, and he does, as exhibit A for why liberalism fails.
So from Reagan's perspective, I guess, and from this sort of rising generation of conservative activists, he spent a lot of time, as I just mentioned, in Pocketbook Politics, showing how New Dealers like quite self-consciously thought of themselves as, we have this program in Washington, D.C., but for like our program to succeed, it can't just be located here. We have to enlist the support of the American people. What's the conservative response to that that you see fleshed out under Reagan? Is it a different kind of mobilized citizenry, or is it just a demobilized citizenry?
Yeah, I'm more focused on the demobilization of the citizenry, I guess. You know, so what just to sort of go back a little bit, their efforts to sort of mobilize around the energy crisis, right? So you have someone like Jesse Jackson, right? I don't spend a lot of time on him, but what is his response to the energy crisis? It's to sort of organize, you know, Operation Push, to lead protests outside of Standard Oil headquarters, you know, to lower prices. This isn't really going to have much traction. So there's sort of these efforts that don't really translate because they don't link up to sort of, they don't translate the same way that they did in an earlier period. And then I see the story of the 80s, as you say, as sort of moment of demobilization. Obviously, you also have conservative grassroots mobilization sort of that sustains Reagan's policies in office. But, you know, his biggest success in terms of economic policy were his tax cuts, right? And Bruce Bartlett, who is sort of a conservative thinker at the time, says, you know, this is genius. You know, the Kemp tax cut bill is genius, you know, because we don't have to do anything. We just cut taxes and then people support us.
It's also claiming this sort of vocabulary of growth that used to be this New Deal liberal argument for the right.
Right. Yeah. So that was really sort of something I was centrally interested in the book, sort of how do you have this shift away from this sort of reciprocal relationship between a strong government and a mobilized citizenry, especially through the union movement, to a world where that connection no longer exists.
Yeah, another, well, and this is, I guess, like a disjunction between the two books, and it's been a bit of a theme in the conversation so far, is like in the first one, you can sort of solidly ground your focus in sort of the U.S. nation, the nation state. It's a domestic story chiefly.
Right.
And this, as you mentioned several times, is so thoroughly a foreign. You can't tell this story just within the United States. It's a global history to a certain extent. And this comes through, I think, most explicitly when you make the argument essentially that one sort of an unintended consequence, or maybe a quasi-intended consequence of deregulation, sort of Reagan's stepping back, is a shift, is an encouraging of American dependence upon the Middle East. And so the Gulf War, you have this fantastic line from the New York Times early in the book where you say that as of like with the Gulf War, foreign policy replaces energy policy. Can you explain how that worked exactly?
Yeah, right. And so whereas in the Nixon administration, sort of all the way through Carter, there was this great fear of dependence, in large part because Washington leaders felt immobilized to sort of take any military action. Obviously, that changes.
And that's another way in which Nixon's a kind of New Dealer, right? Sort of like cordoning off like the U.S. from the global, to some extent, so that you can have like a regulated, prosperous national economy.
And this changes, of course, under Reagan. I mean, Carter is the one to articulate in his Carter doctrine and the centrality of the Persian Gulf to as a vital American national interest, which if threatened will trigger the use of force. But Reagan's the one to really make that commitment more tangible with sort of the creation of a regional command for the Middle East and sort of be committed to expanding America's foreign policy footprint in a more aggressive way in this part of the world. And by the time you have the first Gulf War in 1991, there's no longer the sense that independence is the goal. And you see this quite explicitly. I was kind of amazed in the documents from the George H.W. Bush Library, where they jettison discussion of independence in favor of a language of security. And so as long as we can secure the free flow of oil, which is a position that these conservatives have been articulating for a long time. You know, the most extreme form of this are articles written in the mid-1970s, actually in the Ford period, you know, we'll just seize the oil. You have that sort of mentality that manifests itself under Reagan leading to Bush, that the goal really is security, not independence. So when Hussein invades Kuwait, the response is immediate. Because they've had this perspective in mind for quite some time, and now they have the resources to do it. And by the way, it helps that the Cold War is over, so that you can sort of respond with military force without fear of triggering a bigger war.
That brings us to the end of this book, and you've been really generous with your time. But before I let you go, just a couple questions.
You've been very generous with your interest.
Please, it's great. It's easy when it's a good book. Trust me. But before I let you go. Just a question in thinking about maybe some of the legacies of the account that you sketch in this book here. You mentioned at the start that, you know, there's this 1970s historiography, like a body of scholarship on the 1970s that's very concerned with the rise of the right and sort of portrays like this moment as sort of like leading right to Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you see this book fitting within that trend, which I think if there's been any sort of dominant move in like U.S. political history more generally over the last 10 years or so, it is this sort of centrality of the 70s and like linking that to the emergence of this conservative movement narrative.
Yeah, I think there's a few things. One, I think that gets glossed over or just flatly rejected is this idea that liberalism is dead by this time period, you know, that you just have the disappearance of all of these sort of New Dealer types, and that's just patently wrong.
No one knows that Reagan is going to be elected in 1980.
No one knows Reagan's being elected in 1980. Ted Kennedy, you know, runs a very viable and vibrant challenge from Carter's left in 1980, you know, which was not just some small, you know, vanity project or sideshow, but really had legs. And in that interview that he does with Roger Mudd that everyone says sort of condemns him, like, why do you want to be president? I don't know. What he actually spends much of the time talking about is the energy crisis, and we need to, you know, institute more aggressive price controls, and we need rationing, and, you know, we need all of these sort of heavy-handed governmental solutions. And that's sort of the mentality, and we forget that. In some ways, the 70s is much closer to the 1940s than it is to today. So that's sort of the first thing that I think is an important kind of corrective. Then a second thing is the role of these sort of Washington conservative insiders. So we tend to sort of, again, see this inevitable sort of voting for Ronald Reagan. So we go backwards and we look at sort of all of these grassroots conservatives, and they're there, you know, whether you're sort of talking about the anti-communists or the anti-civil rights or the anti-taxation people, you know, and sort of how, you know, how to sort of mobilize them into a political movement. But to me, what's really sort of interesting are these Washington insiders who sort of see the endurance and, in fact, the expansion of the government in the 1970s. And so when Ronald Reagan comes in and does get elected and he says government is not the problem to solution to our problems, government is the problem, it's because there's been so much government expansion in the 1970s. And these are the guys who know just how to think about trying to undo it. So that, I think, is really important. And then the final piece that I think is central to the book, too, is the sort of linkage between domestic and foreign policy, and not to sort of see those in separate worlds, but to sort of, and it, you know, you can't miss it with the energy crisis, because that is both a domestic and a foreign policy crisis, and to sort of see the way in which those universes operate in tandem. So James Schlesinger, for example, his response to the Gulf War in 1991, and he knew from whence he spoke, he could say, it's a hell of a lot more fun to kick asses in the Middle East than it is to practice conservation at home. So the sort of relationship, especially in the 1970s, as the sort of global world was becoming so much more central to trying to figure out these economic problems.
Speaking of kicking ass in the Middle East, and this will be my last question, somewhat grim one, because we're speaking on the morning that it looks, or the day that it looks like Donald Trump has consolidated the Republican nomination for himself. And this is not so much about your book, but about your expertise as an American political historian more generally. And it links to this literature on the rise of the right, which we're quite familiar with. You know, I was thinking that for your oil story, that you can draw like a line from the people you sketch here to the Republican Party of Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld, even makes sense for another set of like oil plutocrats who I don't think are in the book, but the Koch brothers, mm-hmm. right? That's like, okay, yes, you can see mm-hmm. that narrative, like that makes sense. But in sort of this like revolt of the Trump and proletariat moment, do you think this says something about where, well, it seems like, and this occurred to me because a few weeks ago, I was just putting together for us magazine, like a list of books that might help explain like how we got here. And it was really easy to come up with books that would lead, works of American history from the last generation that would explain how we got to Ted Cruz. Mm-hmm. It was a lot harder to think of ones that would lead to Trump. Do you think this suggests that there's something more, is it a weakness in the literature, or are we like overreacting to a particular moment? Like, where do you think this comes from, and what do you think it says about U.S. history?
Well, let me just say that I won $100 because back in August, I made a bet that, and I only had to bet, I was willing to go much further than this, but I only had to bet that Trump would still be in the election February 1. And this was back in August. So for me, I believe
this has been a glorious time for you. It's massively validated.
Right. So, you know, right. So, you know, that's separate from my political preferences. But to me, he was easy to see coming in a certain way, because I do think that he taps into a certain kind of alienation that we spoke of the voters, a sense that that Washington is not taking care of basic needs, his sort of appeal to working class white voters, his ability to sort of prey on fears. That has a long history in the literature too. And to me, it doesn't manifest itself in sort of religious fundamentalism or something like that.
Or free market ideology.
Yeah, it totally different. So, to me, you can go back to the sort of George Wallace, you can sort of go back and find examples of when someone is promising to remedy their most basic needs, whether that's through sort of an assertive foreign policy, which sometimes he articulates, protectionism, or, you know, this idea that he will do whatever it takes to get it done is something that I think actually has a legacy and that we have seen in the past. And it's not, to me, it wasn't a surprise to see him coming.
All right, great. Meg Jacobs. And you can trust her, not just because she's a great historian, but because she won $100. Thank you so much.
Thank you.